Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to the podcast this afternoon. I have the honor and privilege of having Vish Kanaran. He is the Chief Data Science Officer at Liquid Analytics. They're one of the top leading AI companies here in the U.S., and they're based out of St. Augustine, Florida, and they've got offices in Toronto, Canada as well, too. Vish, thank you for your time this afternoon.
Yes, my pleasure, and as with everything COVID, we're doing this call remotely, yes.
Everything's all remote these days, right? Anyway, well, cool. Let's go ahead and get started. Well, we did some background snooping on you. We didn't do a background check or anything. Don't worry about that. But we looked up your bio. We looked you up on LinkedIn and on Google. And you seem to have a very rich and deep background in cyber, obviously, and artificial intelligence. Could you please tell us some of the highlights of your career and how you kind of how your path took you to where you are today?
Sure. Yeah, so I mean, I've been at least focused very heavily, you know, in this area for a long time in Liquid Analytics. You know, I've been working in Liquid Analytics for over 10 years now, and yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you perfect.
Yep. Yeah. So I've been at Liquid Analytics for about 10 years now, and you know, and so before that, we were also focused on, you know, I think I started up about three companies, and they've all had some aspects of analytics to it. And, you know, over the last 10 to 15 years, as how analytics has evolved from, you know, evolved into AI, we've just basically stayed true to the whole idea of machine learning and AI. So I've been at Liquid Analytics for the last 10 years, and Liquid, the name actually is about analytics and AI. Liquid is about the fluid user experience, and the analytics is about AI, with our entire message really being about how can we help customers experience their AI. And so, you know, I think when we're looking at Liquid Analytics, you know, our whole goal is to focus on solving difficult decision problems. Even our product name is called Liquid Decision. You know, most of the time I spend keeping our AI team as well as customer AI teams on track to deliver, you know, really tactical solutions very fast. And I think what we'll see in this podcast is, the idea that our AI is not just R&D. AI is something that has value that you can apply now, today, and especially in this market with COVID, you know, how important it is. And what we're seeing is customers really, they're not interested in solutions that are 6 months, even 3 months out there. They want solutions that work right now. And so, you know, for most of my career, we've really been very focused on, you know, delivering decision support systems, which evolved into analytics, which eventually evolved into AI, you know, across this career of starting up for companies. Yep.
Cool. Sounds excellent. Yeah, Vish, I just want to let you know, I'm actually writing a book, a very deep dive book about 300 pages long on artificial intelligence as it relates to cybersecurity. So some of my chapters are on like artificial intelligence, neural networks, machine learning, computer vision, and genetic algorithms. And I've learned so much. And on my neural network chapter, I've written like on back propagation networks, you know, Hopfield neural networks, and I've written stuff about, you know, the Lamstar neural. I'm hoping to expand my business into the AI realm too as well. It's really a fascinating field, very, very growing. But now, how did you venture into Liquid Analytics? Was there some trigger or something that kind of allured you to the company? And is this a company that you kind of helped me build and grow from start?
Yeah, I'm actually one of the founders. And
And
all the original founders are still there. It was actually interesting when we were thinking about starting up, and that's how we actually also got the name Liquid Analytics, is we were actually looking at vision and video analytics in the beginning. And we were always focusing on decisions, but, you know, at that point in time, it was just a bit too early for video. And, of course, now that you see things with AI is, you know, the number one area that we see success in AI. In fact, there's really only four areas that where AI is standing out right now. One is vision, you know, in terms of is this a cat? Is this not a cat? It does a really good job. So, you know, video vision recognition is great. Cybersecurity is definitely an area that almost predates that. People don't realize this, but AI is really being the heart and soul of cybersecurity. The third area is, of course, natural language recognition. I think it's done an incredible job of redefining natural language. And the fourth area, which sort of segues a lot into what we're doing, is the area of AI with gamification. The AI being used, especially with DeepMind, Google's lab, in training chess algorithms without any historical data, to basically not only beat every human but also beat every machine out there, and do this in and it sounds crazy, but do this in a matter of hours with very little historical data. And so a lot of this stuff, we're not necessarily building games, but we're using these concepts to help build decision systems, and really decision systems around optimizing risk and increasing profit margins. So it's a slightly different thing, but you're absolutely correct in terms of how AI has evolved. I think one of the challenges is knowing where it works and where it doesn't work. This is still a growing field, and I think the road ahead for AI is far, not only is it far bigger, but it's far more exciting than it has been in the past. Where we were are just baby steps.
Okay. Now, that's posing some other questions that kind of just popped in my head, if you don't mind me asking you, is talking about computer vision and videos, have you guys dealt with the deep fakes kind of cyber attack? It's kind of where not to get political here, but you kind of have Donald Trump and I can't remember what the neural network is. It might be the convoluted neural network, but that mimics everything to replicate what he looks like on another video, but they actually will direct the end user to go to spoofed website to give a donation to an offshore account. Have you ever dealt with anything like that in your work right now, deepfakes?
Yeah, so you're probably talking about what we call adversarial networks or adversarial algorithms, and GANs specifically, generative. Yeah, so we're not specifically focused on any part of the market in terms of doing deep fakes for vision type systems, but we do use that in terms of the idea from a gamification perspective in terms of scenario planning is useful. So we're not necessarily doing it to basically hack into some system. Cybersecurity is not our specific focus, or vision systems isn't our specific focus. It is using those algorithms to help us gamify and help companies make decisions. And I think we're probably in this podcast, we'll probably be talking a lot more about knowledge graphs and specific pieces like that. And I think we can address how we have solved or addressed the issue of security and knowledge graphs for sure.
Okay. Right. Now, I also have a background in biometrics, and I know that computer vision is being used in conjunction with facial recognition. Have you heard anything about that being done, the two working together in harmony with one another, facial recognition and computer vision?
So you're saying computer vision and facial? Oh, yeah. I mean, we have, but it's just not. It's not an area for liquid analytics.
Okay.
It's not. I wouldn't consider ourselves experts in that area at all. Where you're actually leading to is in terms of, and we'll address this also with the knowledge graph, is the idea that there's not going to be just one way of doing something, and it's really mashing up information from multiple sources that's going to give AI power. I think one of the challenges with AI is it's in some areas it's too specific. You wonder why a human or a child can make, or even a cat can make, better decisions. Is they have greater context, and they're adding, they're making their decision based upon multiple streams of information and not necessarily just one stream of information. We see that a lot with business decisioning systems. And so you talk about both how do I mix biometrics with vision recognition. You may want to go further and mix that with voice recognition as well. So, when you look at a person and you say, as a security guard, you say, is this person the right person or not the right person? Should I friend or foe identification? You're not just looking at that biometric fingerprint. You're not just looking at, sometimes people will look at the type of shoe somebody's wearing and say, hey, that's not a standard, that's not a standard outfit. This person is not really a military officer. This person's pretending to be one. Maybe I want to stop them. You know, so there's a lot more things that go into that I believe that what we need to do is create this interconnected set of relationships that give the AI a better holistic context before it starts to jump to conclusions. Because the other area is, of course, bias. We're talking about right now using both vision recognition systems to determine if somebody should be arrested or not. I mean, if those things are just built by one person with one input, they're definitely going to be biased. And, worse than biased is they're going to be incomplete. And that's going to be an issue. And we see that quite often, where AI is only as good as the person who trained it and with the limited set of data that they trained it with.
Okay. Well, now, how long has Liquid Analytics been in business?
We've been in business for 10 years now. That's a very fast 10 years. So we've been in business for 10 years, and I'd like to say profitably. Having done a few startups, I think one of the lessons I've learned is that, this concept of zero burn and be profitable. I think too many companies out there are always looking for the quick exit and, it's like lipstick on a pig, if you will. We really built the company from the ground up to make sure we have real products. We've always been profitable. And in fact, profitability is our message that we take back to customers too, right? How do I help you use AI to generate alpha or profitability? How do I help you optimize your risk? How do I help you optimize your cash flow? These are heart and soul things that Liquid Analytics has done. And we've been in business for 10 years. We're primarily focused on, the finance, operations, sales, distribution, communication markets. Our product is Liquid Decisions. And there's really no intrinsic vertical for our product. If you want to solve cash flow, risk management, profitability analysis type problem, then Liquid Decisions is probably a good fit. But we're trying to stay very, very focused. We're not trying to be everything to everybody. We're really trying to say, how are we applying knowledge graphs to help you make decisions about your business?
Okay. Just a couple more questions about your companies before we segue into knowledge graphs. Does Liquid Analytics have a presence in other countries as well, or are you just more focused on the U.S. and the Canadian markets?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for us, and I think, and this is going to be true for everybody who is post-COVID, it's pre-COVID and post-COVID, I don't think the geography applies anymore. You and I are as connected, whether, we're connected virtually, and we have done business with customers in Europe, and so we don't actually look at it that way. It just happens to be a lot of the customers we do business with have had offices in the United States. When you're dealing with global companies that are located worldwide, it has never been an issue for us to work worldwide. We do have resources in other countries. Even our employees, right? We are not looking for, a specific employee in a specific location. We're looking for the best employees anywhere. Companies like GitHub, for example. Microsoft just purchased GitHub. That entire company is virtual. And I think that's really the future. And, we've been operating like that for a while. We do have an AI lab in Montreal in Canada. We've invested in that, and we think Montreal is a great place to build an AI team.
Okay, excellent. Now, who is your typical customer base like? Is it the SMBs or Fortune 500 or kind of mix and match of both? Who do you try to target? What's your sweet spot, in other words, for your services and products?
Another good pre-COVID, post-COVID question, and I think this is going to be, hopefully this will give people an idea of how they need to think about their business. We've typically, and it's not because we intentionally targeted this thing, it just happens to be because of our partnerships. You know, we've had some significant partnerships with larger companies, and so we ended up targeting larger enterprise companies. So we've typically targeted large enterprises in either the finance or the sales distribution, or the some manufacturing space that is trying to get services or products out to their customers. And of course, I separate out finance as a very special category. So that has been our traditional space. Now, things have changed since post-COVID, and they didn't really change for us post-COVID because we actually had. And I think a lot of people, so it's not being smart or anything. You know, a lot of people have figured a downturn was coming in 2020. And so we had already started on, in 2020, lighter weight applications that could apply to smaller businesses. And now what we're seeing is every business is a small business. Every business is in a new market, or you're dead. You know, you don't want to, you know, you're going to, you know, if you think like a large company and you think business as usual and you think this is a V recovery, you're going to be in for a nice surprise. And not a nice surprise, actually. And so we are starting to come up with lighter weight solutions that apply to mid-market, small businesses. You know, even from a community perspective, I think it's time for us to all think about, especially companies like Liquid that are, you know, we're gonna survive this thing, is to think about how important local businesses are to this economy. And, you know, you can't just centralize everything into one giant big box company in the cloud that supplies everything online. You know, we are defined by our neighborhoods, and so we're trying to create a lot of solutions that target local financial institutions, local stores, consumer product services stores, and you'll start to see us coming up with lighter weight products that people can deploy and implement very quickly. There's no restriction necessarily to say that those things will not work for larger organizations as well.
Okay, excellent. Now, I'm at your website right now, and you've got a wide range of offerings. You know, you do everything from, it looks like, from wine, spirits, you know, food distribution, finances, you just elaborate on. You do stuff with ERP, CRMs, like SAP, I don't know about Salesforce. Can you expand a little bit more into your product and service offerings, and are these all SaaS-based solutions?
I mean, first of all, I would like to say you're definitely not in sales. We're not trying to be everything to everybody, and I think what you're going to see is you're going to see some changes in the website, and the real main focus is Liquid Decisions as a product, and it just happens to be we do quite a business with the wine and spirits industry, and that's been a pretty good industry at this time, and we're really looking across that entire supply chain from supplier to distributor to stores, even directly to the consumer, of really how do we help that entire chain work more seamless. And so, you know, you're starting to see a lot of great things with distributors in terms of trying to reduce that friction. And really that's what we're doing. We're focusing a lot, and that's why you tend to see that. You know, you can look at Liquid Decisions as a decisioning platform generally, or we can actually target it to very specific verticals, which then integrate into your ERP system. So, you know, that's why we become a natural fit to companies who have ERP systems, because we can integrate with them, because that's where your internal content lives. We are a SaaS solution. Our goal is to stay cloud neutral and hybrid cloud. And the reason is not because of any, you know, the reason is because we want to bring our services to our customers and not have our customers come to us. I think one of the things that we're seeing with data, with AI specifically, there's so much data involved. I don't think companies really want to move that data out of their cloud. So if I have a service and tell a customer, hey, I'm going to analyze your 100 million invoice line items, and I'll tell you exactly what your next product to buy is and who your next best customer is, and I can give you a lot of information if you give me your invoice line items and your product data, they're going to be like, that's my secret sauce. My data is my secret sauce. It can't leave my organization. And so what we do is we have more of a hybrid solution, so that if you are, for example, in Microsoft Azure, we want to come to you. You know, we want you to leverage the best of Azure or Google Cloud Platform, for example, or Amazon. And we'll deploy our services inside and our algorithms inside of your environment as a space. And that's really important both for security as well as, you know, moving data is expensive. You know, you got to think about the functions coming to the data and not the data coming to the functions.
Oh, excellent.
Think of it as a SaaS model. However, in some ways, we're going a little bit back into the future where we're actually now companies are, or at least we are, we're deploying software into your enterprise. It just happens to be your enterprise is in the cloud as well.
Excellent. Okay. Now let's go into the knowledge graphs area here. Now, what are knowledge graphs and how do you see them growing in terms of enterprise-grade solutions?
So let's look at that word knowledge graph. It has its functional roots as a knowledge base. It has its functional roots as a knowledge base used by Google in its services to basically enhance its search engine, you know, based upon all the information it's gathered from various sources. So really Google has this concept of a knowledge graph that makes it so easy for you to type something in a search bar and find specifically what you're looking for, because it's really traversing a knowledge graph to do that. In the English language, the word graph means so many different things. Like sometimes people, when they think about the word graph, they think, you know, I use the word chart, and there, you know, which means I'm drawing a nice picture of, you know, when I think about, if I look at, you know, some business intelligence report, that's a chart for me. In mathematics, a graph is really a network of relationships between, you know, between objects. They talk about nodes as the objects and edges as the relationships between objects. So a graph is, you know, for us, then we have the concept of a graph database, right? And the graph database is the persistence layer. And so you just have to know where the word is being used. So you will probably store your knowledge graph in a graph database. And that graph database hopefully is something that's scalable, fault tolerant, and low latency. And there are very, very few databases out there that actually meet those requirements. A lot of the cloud databases are starting to do that right now. But your typical average SQL database today really only scales vertically. I mean, it's not really built as a sharded system, as a distributed system. There are databases out there like Google Spanner, Yugabyte, et cetera, that are sharded, and Microsoft has some of their offerings as well. So now we've taken care of this concept of, you know, what a graph is and what a graph database is, and we're looking at the origins of this term knowledge graph from Google, which has used this as a way of enhancing search. What we think about a knowledge graph, it's sort of like the cumulative cognizance of your company information. So we basically look at it as, you know, think about all of the entities, objects, you can call them nodes, whatever, that are important to your company, and figure out how they all relate to each other. And those relationships form edges. And so a knowledge graph is really, the way we look at it is, a knowledge graph is the best representation of your domain. And that's really the first problem that you want to solve at AI, right? You want to basically say, I want to eliminate this mismatch between domain and data. And if you cannot, you first have to be able to describe your company in context of your data. And we believe describing it as a knowledge graph is the easiest and most intuitive way of doing so. So when we think about a knowledge graph, we think about it as a way to define the relationships and the interconnectivity of your company, both internally and externally. Like if you look at it, you can think about it as content, external data, and natural language, for example, right? So we'll form those deep and wide relationships with internal content. Then all of a sudden you want to augment that with external data, maybe from demographics, local demographics, maybe social media data, policy information, and I will show you some examples of policy information for COVID, for example, that may affect how you behave in a particular neighborhood, to financial information very quickly. And then, of course, natural language itself incorporates the specific language and relationships that you use internally and with your customers. So, I think if you're really thinking about what is this definition of knowledge graph, yeah, the word has its original roots with Google search engine. And then what we do is we say it's a way of just representing your company as data. That's really what it is. A knowledge graph is how do I describe my company? With a knowledge graph. And that's another thing that we see is when people are solving AI, and this goes to the context of point-specific solutions and narrow solutions. And, you know, you wonder why your AI is not performing as well as a child. Well, that's because you're building separate silos, and people start off with the data first, right? They start off with this data, but not the query, right? You have to first know what answers you want, you know, what questions you want answered, and then figure out the best way to represent that data. And unfortunately, in today's world, everybody thinks SQL databases, and they've stuffed their stuff in SQL databases, these SQL data warehouses. They haven't even thought about a single question before they stuff their data in there. You don't know how much data you're missing, and then when you go to another solution, you start the whole process. You kind of try to start the whole process over again. You know, you have a data lake, which is really a data swamp, which you can't fish anything out of. And so I try to get customers to see how valuable it is to really think about not data, but knowledge and the interconnectivity of that knowledge as a knowledge graph.
Okay, excellent. Now, how is machine learning coupled with knowledge graphs, and what's the objective of that union or coupling?
Okay. Well, that's a good question. I mean, so first of all, there are many problems that are search and network traversal problems naturally. Without getting into the technical weeds, if you look around and see that in most cases, the real world, the starting point is a graph and not some sort of bounded table. And when I try to get people to think about graphs and knowledge graphs, and they go, well, whoa, wait a minute, that's something totally alien to me. And I'm saying, well, before you even got into work, right, you have to get to work. You're using graphs whether you know it or not, especially if you put a map up on your screen, right? So you put this map up on a screen, you know your starting point, and you know your destination. And then what happens is a decisioning engine, some mapping program, is basically going to give you a set of paths to get from where you are to where you're going. Maybe there's an accident, maybe there's road construction, maybe there's a peaceful protest along the way. Whatever it is, you probably want to figure out a different route, and you want the AI to help you get from point A to point B. And so my first thing is, most problems that you're going to see are going to be graph-related problems. So how machine learning couples with graphs is that if I have a better representation of, if my data better represents my domain, then I'm going to spend less time traversing that domain to find answers. I start to think about everything like search. And that's one of the most powerful things that we see. Because, you know, people today are starting these things with these bounded tables. They start off with these data frames that are massively wide and massively deep. And there's such a big disconnect between that data frame, for example, as a flat Euclidean space versus what they really have, which is this unbounded graph problem that they really need to solve. And, you know, the Euclidean space has been really great for vision systems. It's done a great job in terms of looking at, X and Y pixels and being able to do recognition. Of course, it's done a great job, but we're also starting to see that it doesn't take very much to rearrange a set of pixels, and what you thought was a cat now looks like an elephant, even though to a normal eye, it still looks like an elephant. And the reason for that is because you're missing additional context. So what I would say is, like, even the very term neural net implies a graph. So the coupling between machine learning and knowledge graphs is a far more natural context. And we at Liquid want to eliminate that disconnect between the AI, the data, and the domain. Like, we want to think about, if you see your domain as a graph, you want to represent the data as a graph, and then we want you to find the simplest AI solution as if you're just searching for answers across your knowledge graph. And then AI, specifically AI, bottom line is, think of AI as the agent for answering questions across this nested graph. And the beautiful thing about it is you can start small. You can say, I want to only answer this question for recommended products. Maybe I only want to recommend products based upon my neighborhood. I want to find out what my neighborhood is buying in terms of products, and then I, as a store, I want to carry those products. And then I maybe want to add another algorithm to it. You know, the wonderful thing is we can just keep adding smaller and smaller set of agents that we can get to market faster with. But they're all working in context of the same data, the same knowledge graph.
Okay, excellent. Now, how can organizations mitigate the difficulties of integrating, you know, all these data sets from different systems that, you know, may not even be interlinked with each other into knowledge graph? and then from there shoot that into the machine learning system and get the desired outputs?
Okay. Well, so first of all, data is the Achilles heel of machine learning, and this does not go away. So there's no inherent barrier to putting data into a knowledge graph. It uses the same APIs. You know, you can use remote procedure calls, you can use REST, and even, you know, there's a lot of companies now are looking at GraphQL, which is sort of like the evolution of just using plain old REST. And GraphQL actually has a graph, you know, conceptually it's thinking in terms of a graph, hence it's called GraphQL. So that's also a great way, by the way, if companies from a technical point of view are trying to understand graphs and trying to think about how do I get data into a graph, that's a great way. It's more intuitive way, I would say. So when you're trying to bring data in, one of the challenges, of course, with SQL is you kind of have to know your data structure because you create your schemas in advance. So you end up creating all these schemas only to find out that you've got a lot of fields that mean the same thing and all of these wonderful things. But with a graph, it has the advantage of very much like SQL, which has entities and relationships. You have nodes and edges, which is very, very similar, actually. But you can actually, it's almost schemaless, right? It's not like you have to know your schema in advance. So your graph can grow with you. Your knowledge grows with you. So you don't have to try to boil that ocean and try to get all of that data in there to start. You can start getting data, and this is what, and we see this all the time, because we take your company data, we augment it with maybe demographic data. Maybe I want to get Yelp or Google Places data in there. Then I want to aggregate. Then I want to add some information about policy data for a local county government, for local county and city government. Maybe I want to, I want to add additional information for COVID health data.
Excellent.
So, you know, it's actually easier. So the bottom thing is I think it's actually easier to get data into a graph because you're eliminating some unnecessary hurdles.
Okay, excellent. Now, on the topic of structured data and unstructured and studying structured data, how do knowledge graphs actually kind of unify all of them together? And how are they different from the graph database?
So a graph database is technically a persistent store, right? So we just talked about what a graph database is. You know, at a lowest level, a sentence is a relationship of meanings, right, represented by words and its grammar. And because a knowledge graph has this ability to have billions, and I mean billions of edges, its relationships, we break the boundary between what is structured and unstructured. What we typically used to call structured data in the past was really structured query language data, like SQL data. And what was unstructured was English language. So we take that structured or unstructured data and break it down to foundational elements and form relationships between these data elements. We're sort of basically starting to treat both the structured and unstructured data in a similar way. For us, both are basically grammars that try to form relationships between objects. And those relationships are there to either describe, change, or request data. And so really, the knowledge comes from our intents derived from that data. So I actually feel that knowledge graphs, because natural language fits so well with knowledge graphs, it's a great way of bringing in structured and semi-structured or unstructured data because, you know, you're going to have more information that's unstructured than it is structured. You're going to have lots of data coming in from tweets and from your various different chat systems and conversations with your clients, and that's far more current than any data from, say, 2019 that probably is not relevant anymore.
Okay, excellent. Now, getting back to the machine learning concept, how can the coupling of machine learning, or ML as it's called, and the knowledge graphs help companies, you know, whether they're small, big, or medium-sized, how can it help them to overcome the obstacles that COVID-19 has faced during this pandemic and during these last few months?
Okay, that's a good question, and hopefully you can deal with a big answer.
That's great.
So I'll first answer the question directly. So I'll tell you how we're doing it. So we've talked about how it's easier for us to build machine learning algorithms because we have a graph. You know, we can simplify a lot of problems because we break them down into search. So we basically said, stop thinking about this thing as some complicated neural network when maybe all you wanted to do was search. A knowledge graph is going to help you solve those particular problems. Right? Nothing goes away. We're just trying to make it easier with a knowledge graph. And so specifically for COVID-19, I mean, here's what we're doing. When we're looking for, like, let's say neighborhood stores that really are suffering right now, and part of their suffrage is a lot of the data is either, it's just missing. And some data is actually missing, it's misleading. Like if you look at a lot of the government data, for example, maybe because of political issues, et cetera, is actually not being published correctly. Like, you know, in the state of Florida, for example, they're reporting health, you know, you report a COVID data, they'll report the number of people that are infected. When you get, you know, they'll count the number of people who test positive as one, but they'll count the number of people who get tested as one as well. But they double count people who get tested twice. And so what that makes it look like, it makes it look like the percentage of people that are getting infected to tested is much lower than it really is. And you know, so you're a store and you have no idea and you're getting all this information. Well, you know, what you're really trying to do is how can I help a store manage their operational costs and their labor costs? If you give the wrong data, then suddenly they open and there's nobody coming into the store and they have to pay for labor. They need to know their traffic patterns. They need to know about local policies. They need to know about events because this goes beyond COVID, right? You could be in Minneapolis and there could be a peaceful protest going on somewhere and you want to be on the right side of the protest. You want to say, how do I support that protest versus being on the wrong side of that protest, right? So you want to know a lot about local data and you want to know it in the real time. And so it's not really about the data you have. It's about a lot of external data that we've already mashed up that can bring all of this stuff together that can help you make what I call instant local decisions that determine when you stay open. Do I do curbside pickup? Do I deliver products in certain types of neighborhoods? And so it's, you know, this is our way of, in a sense, figure out how we give back to local stores so that they can jumpstart their businesses. And that's whether it's a local financial institution, consumer product, or a personal services company. That's number one. Number two is how do I mash up, again, COVID data, health data, traffic data, financial data, demographic data, to figure out who your NBC is, meaning next best customer. And I want to individually target that customer. You know, and customers want immediate solutions more than ever, whether it's from healthcare to essential products and services to financial services. And if I can get that local data as a store and mash that up with my internal data of what I do, maybe there's a chance for me to target customers directly. And then finally, from a machine learning knowledge graph perspective is, you know, I always say, and I guess we've always said this and everybody said this, but nobody's listened, you know, cash flow is king. So we're trying to help companies look for bad debt, late payments, and buying patterns. And what's interesting to see is you'll find that just by looking at historical buying patterns, there are some people out there who just want to pay. And those are going to be some of your best paying customers. The only difference is people are buying different things right now. So what we see is that with a graph, these are not isolated projects anymore, right? This is a single knowledge graph that I'm building many lightweight and interconnected AI models to sort of create holistic decisions. Most important is I don't have to boil the ocean to get started. I don't have to get all this data to get started. I can start small, I can see results quickly, and I can add what I need when I need it. What we're seeing is customers, when the customers come to us or we go to customers, it's like, if I don't have a solution for them that's going to address their need like right now, for now or the next 2 weeks or this month, it's like, come back. You know, for them, their world exists today. And so I think the coupling of machine learning and knowledge graphs, especially for COVID, I think is pretty awesome, where it's helping people better operate locally, figuring out their next best customer, or managing their cash flow. One thing I'm going to say, though, is don't think about COVID as COVID. Right, there's going to be mutations. This thing is not going away. There's no V recovery. right, just the virus. Right, when climate change hits us, this is going to be even bigger than COVID. When AI automation starts to take away more jobs, that's going to be another tipping point event. And of course, we're seeing, you know, that's the third. You know, you got viruses, you got climate change, you've got AI automation, and then you've got this clash between the old cultures and the new progressive cultures that represent the future. All of these things are volatility, and we no longer live in what I call a single factor of the world, which is momentum. You know, 2 years ago, if you said, what's the market going to do? You're going to say going up. Today, we are dealing with volatility, and so you need to deal with a multi-factor model. And that's really what we bring to the table, is the ability for you to see, you know, what are the factors that affect my business today? What is my view of those factors of where I want to go, and how can we get you there?
Okay, excellent. Well, now, for those businesses that actually have a dedicated software development team, what do I mention to them about technology stacks? I mean, are there any technologies or tools that they need to be using specifically?
Well, first thing is, your number one risk is stop looking at technology for this. Like, too many, you know, we work with companies and it's almost always we're dealing with IT and we're dealing with people who, I know Python, right? It's like, this is not a technology problem. I mean, the whole point of calling it a knowledge graph versus calling it a database or something like that is to really think about the domain of data that you have. And what we find is finance people have sometimes a better statistics background, have a better finance, have a better understanding of factors than the IT people. And I think the first thing is don't get hijacked by technology vendors and by technology. What you really saw, you have to look at AI as purely as a business problem. Now, so organizations are going to start to morph, and you know, one of the first things is, you know, that entire SQL problem can actually, how many companies out there, raise your hand, it's like you spent the last year, you're probably still doing it, and you're still trying to perfect it, you're spending so much time on data lakes and SQL-oriented data warehouses, and you think you've done a great job. Your business says, well, what did I get? What decisions did I get for that? And you probably don't, you know, a lot of companies, there's some big companies that have some amazing results, but by and large, it's like the, you know, you can count these people on your hand. So I would really recommend, one is, you know, Microsoft has great tools in their cloud. You know, Google has great tools. So, just, you know, go into the cloud. That's your number one space. Go into the cloud. And so, but don't necessarily go into these clouds just to implement some technology, some vendor's product. As soon as some vendor starts to talk to you about a product first, you're probably on the wrong track. so, you know, and like I said, our goal is really, you know, regardless of what cloud you're in, we're going to bring our functions to you versus trying to have you to try to go to somewhere else. Now, if you still press me on the question about technology, like I said, from an API, you know, API everything, there is some data living somewhere and I need to have an API getting to it. You know, if you just wanted to start small, try to understand GraphQL if you're trying to understand graphs in general. GraphQL is, like I said, sort of like the evolution of REST APIs. That's a great place to start. There's a lot of great graph databases out there. You know, I'm not purposefully trying to plug any one particular graph database, but I look for a horizontally scalable graph database so that it's low latency. It can survive failures of nodes. You know, there's this one graph database called Zgraph, for example, that is actually uses GraphQL as its API. So it's a really intuitive way of actually putting things into the graph, and you can start small, and you can constantly add nodes and add relationships. So, you know, my first thing is, and of course it's cloud neutral, we're running Azure, AWS, and the Google Cloud Platform. Another thing I would say is, you know, you talked about data and you talked about tools. And again, everybody gets hijacked by the tools and spends all their time with the data, you know, and really what they're doing is dumpster diving for data. And I will say most internal data and most external data is garbage. I will say that emphatically. And so, you know, take a look at things like we have done is like looked at for the last couple of years, we've been following DeepMind. You know, Google has the MuZero algorithm, for example. And here was a great way, like we have to start learning without a perfect simulator. We don't have a perfect simulator. There's no, if you had a simulator, you kind of have the answer, right? There is no perfect simulator, and we don't have all historical data. We're really, truly all startups in a brave new world. And one of the things that we saw with the MuZero algorithms is the ability to take two of these guys and have them play chess against each other with no historical context at all. And you know, play a million games against each other and basically build your data, build your own training. And within a couple of hours, you've basically beaten every single person and every single machine on the planet. And let's face it, most data that you're pulling in, you're going to spend so much time cleaning up this data and fixing this data and biasing this data because, one, you're not trying to go to the past anymore. You're trying to go to the future. And so, you know, I ask, I really strongly tell people, it's like, you got to know where you know, you're standing here today. Do you want to go back to where you were, or do you want to go into the future? And if you're trying to march into that future, you should start to think about synthetic data. And that's probably a separate podcast for us, because, you know, we have an entire context in terms of helping companies create synthetic data to train their systems. Don't get me wrong. We want data, and we look at a lot of historical data, but it's not the only answer.
Right. Well, speaking of which, I'll let you know our podcast. So thank you for that chime in there. Okay. Now, what risks do SMBs, Fortune 500 companies, what have you, face when they try to implement artificial intelligence technologies, and how will it impact cybersecurity? Because, you know, for every good side, there's always a bad side. And as a content generator, I've been reading a lot about how AI can be used for the bad side, by the cyber tech. Can you elaborate more on that, please?
Yeah, and I think the bad guys are winning. And the bad guys are winning because we're always looking for short-term results, and we're, they're state actors now. I won't use any specific countries, but there's some state actors out there that are, strong intent of breaking into your system, taking your data for whatever purpose. And it's not just them, right? Even when you put your data in the cloud or put it into any other system, right, there's no tagging of data when you're doing a training system. You're just putting in raw tabular data. And when you're putting in that raw tabular data into somebody's AI engine, they're going to tell you, oh, yeah, I'm going to use this data to help improve my algorithm. Sure, they're using that data to improve the algorithm. For them to do that, they have to have access to that data. So a lot of companies are putting their data out there in the cloud, not realizing they're putting their most sensitive information in somebody's cloud. Maybe that cloud provider is competing with you, right? Maybe you're a consumer product company and that cloud provider is a consumer product company. And, who knows how they're going to use that information to help build their own algorithms for when they eventually compete with you. So it's not just bad actors, it's competitors as well that you don't realize. Your competitor isn't, GM's competitor wasn't Ford, right? GM's competitor was Tesla. So it's quite possible as a consumer product company, your competitor is really Amazon, and not necessarily the next guy down the street. And they're going to do a much better job than you are for whatever business that you're trying to do. So one of the things that's very important for us is when we think about a graph, we think about a graph of graphs. So we overlay our knowledge graph with a security graph. And that security graph, and again, I bring back the analogy that you're driving down a road, which is all your edges, and you have all these houses and buildings and shops and enterprises and stuff that you see, and those are your nodes. Well, when you're driving, you come into your house, you enter the code, you get into your own home, you have full access, right? But you can go into this place, which is a store, and it's open between these hours, and this place over here, you just can't get into. So what we do is we overlay on top of the graph what road somebody can go down, what node somebody can access. And so we're not really looking at security just at a table level. We're dealing with it on a node and a relationship at an element level. And if you don't have access to that, you don't get that data. We're also starting to see, how can we actually keep the data encrypted continuously? So I think that's also a very important thing. And then we have an anonymizer, where we try to anonymize the information. So, we ask ourselves, what is really the information that we need to make this decision? And if it, and this is almost a binary thing here. So we always eliminate anything to do with PII or personally identifiable information before we start to do any of the analysis work. So what's important is our knowledge graph from the beginning, from the get-go, is got a security layer on top of it. Second is we anonymize information. Three is we bring our algorithms to you versus you giving us your data. So there's no conversation about your data leaving your organization. With AI, it's not the runtime. The runtime creates the model. It's the training, right? It's the training that costs the most amount of money, and that's where your biggest hole is in terms of data. Like every development organization has dev and QA, and they don't really care about security when they're doing dev and QA. Nobody has.
Right.
They put all the security as an afterthought in the end. Well, guess what? Your hole is not at the end. Your hole is in the beginning. And when you're training your system and you said, oh, yeah, my I don't know how many people, where they basically put large data sets, they have their little 1, 2, 3 passwords, and they put it into, let's say, Amazon or whatever, got a whole bunch of data sitting in S3, and they go, oh, don't worry, we'll clean it up after the fact. It's just they're missing the point. You need to build security from the get-go, and it's not your grandfather's Buick security, right? It's not the same anymore, right? You really need to think about security right at the training level. And this goes back to how we think about solving for problems, right? If we think about maybe your first set of problems are search problems, you actually reduce your training issue. If you realize that most of your garbage is data to begin with, you reduce this whole idea of moving a lot of data back and forth, and you start to look at more synthetic data that doesn't really have your secrets, but actually has how you would want to model your business. So this is definitely a bigger conversation that we probably want to talk about later.
Excellent. Now, as we come close down to wrapping up our show, let me see here. What advice do you give leaders, organizations, CIOs, CISOs, software development managers, so forth, advice on if they face any barriers into implementing machine learning tools or AI tools into their organization? Like when they're trying to kick off a project or just having a hard time,
right.
What do you tell them to actually help them with it?
And, you know, we've seen successes and failures and all that stuff, and there's a lot to learn from that. I think the number one thing is you've got to – bias is your biggest and I don't mean just, like, racial bias and things like that. You have biases to come to market. You have biases to not want to throw away what you have. You have biases in terms of wanting to please business units. You got to come to this with the assumption that you're not just automating a bad process. Okay, you've got to realize there's no such thing as automating a bad process, because otherwise you're just using RPA and putting lipstick on a pig. And maybe that's useful because you can reduce some costs in the short term here and there. But the reality is you're trying to change a process. That's the first thing. And I think you have to have strong-willed leaders that are willing to question assumptions and make mistakes. And yes, you can do this in a cost-effective manner. You're facing multiple tipping points. You have to realize that, and you have to understand this issue of volatility. Like, don't ever think that, oh, now I got my perfect AI, right? Oh, I solved for COVID. Okay, fine. The next thing is going to come, and the next thing is going to come. So you have to have that flexibility that you're constantly maintaining your algorithm. So there's this concept of concept drift. And concept drift is really the fact that just like a human being, you can't just take knowledge and say it's infinitely usable, right? It has a half-life. And that half-life most likely is measured in 6 months. Which means that within 3 to 6 months, you have to be prepared to, and I say continuously, but fine, 6 to 3 months, is you have to maybe retrain the model. Maybe you have to update the model. And, you know, we look at it as a dynamic process that says if information is changing, it has the potential to change the model very quickly. You've got to basically plan to deliver, fail fast, really super duper important. Don't be afraid to fail. And definitely do not get hijacked by technology, especially technology vendors. I don't know how many times working with customers, the conversation completely gets lost from actual business problem to evaluating vendors. You got to have the problem statement. You have to say, what's my problem statement? What's my target variable that I'm trying to solve for? And do I have the data? Do I need to create the data? You know, understand my security context. And then we can talk about bringing vendors into the problem, because maybe that's not the issue that you want to solve. And, you know, most of the time, if you're going to have leaders, if you're a CEO or a COO of a company and you're looking to put in the right players for AI, make sure that that person has a basic understanding of statistics. It's very important, because that's really at the heart and soul. And then finally, the positive side to this is nobody's going to say no to algorithms that try to optimize risk, you know, increase profits, identify new customers, and most important, increase cash flow. So that's probably the advice that I would give to leaders. And then, you know, the final point I would say is, remember, data describes your business. You know, avoid that mismatch. We believe the knowledge graph is the place to start. And I know we're at the end. Just if you need more information, I would suggest you reach out to one of our AI ambassadors, such as Scott Cavanaugh. I know he's on the call. And, you know, it's just scott.cavanaugh@liquidanalytics.com. Mm-hmm. And then finally, just remember, every one of you, I don't care how large or small you are, the bigger you are, the harder you're going to fall. just remember, you're now a startup in a new market, and we're all part, every one of us is all part of this interconnected graph, you know, and then we're all working together to sort of like build a new future.
Okay, excellent. Do you have any final parting words for listeners, or how can they reach out to you? Can they reach out to you specifically, Vish, or should I just reach out directly? Or?
Yep, and I'm literally everywhere. I got myself an RV now, so I don't fly and I drive around.
Oh.
But I'm either living in Florida or living in Montreal in Canada, and I kind of go back and forth between the two places. Right now I'm in Florida.
Okay.
But again, physical presence doesn't matter. You can actually reach me at my first name dot last name, which is Vish, V-I-S-H dot Kannaran, at liquidanalytics.com. And of course, you can reach out to Scott as well at scott.kavanaugh@liquidanalytics.com. And lately, I haven't been leaving the office, so you can reach me at any time.
Okay. Vish, we thank you so much for your time this afternoon. We learned a lot. I've learned a lot, as I said, I'm writing this book on AI, and it's been a very deep learning process, and I think you've actually spoken about some more stuff that I want to add into my book, too. So thank you very much for your time once again. We look really forward to having you again on to a future podcast soon, hopefully.
You have an awesome week, and the future is in front of us. I think all of these events is just that 2030 is coming early, so there's the bright side.
Exactly. Take care. Thanks.
Cheers. Bye-bye.